This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Style File, where we cover everything and anything on the business of fashion. I'm Azura Rahman, and for this week's Style Maker, we have Bia Sampson from the Philippines.
In the Philippines, the way I saw it was, if the other designers could do it, I believe I could. And I really wanted my own brand.
After that, Lee Chulin and I will go over what's made headlines in the fashion industry.
Every time we see ASOS send an email to us saying 15% off for the next 24 hours, we're part of the problem. We're leading to this woman having a panic attack.
And finally, Emma Chong Johnson of Elle Malaysia gets all hung up with the trend for velvet.
This time we're looking at it in a lot of lighter shades, so not your traditional kind of dark purples and things like that. This time it's paler, so yellows, pale pinks, just really kind of nice, light, fresh colours.
First up though, our style maker for this week, Bea Sampson. Recent KL Fashion Week 2016 having come and passed, the Malaysian fashion scene is abuzz with conversation on the latest collections that appeared on the runway. Among some of the emerging designers that got to debut their work this year was Bea Sampson, who represented the Philippines as one of the three finalists in AirAsia's Runway Ready Designer Search. Not a new name in her homeland, Bea's creations have walked the stages of Filipino exhibits and competitions, as well as Manila Fashion Festival. Now having made her mark in the Pearl of the Orient, Bea is now crossing the borders of Manila and aiming to promote Filipino talent globally with her intricate designs and exaggerated silhouettes, both for men and women. I caught up with Bea on the phone as she shared her first experience at KL Fashion Week and her views on the Filipino fashion industry. Now, Bea, you have recently made your debut here in KL Fashion Week for the AirAsia Runway Ready Designer Search. Now, it's not obviously your first rodeo. You've been around in Philippines for quite some time now. Tell us about your entrance into the fashion industry. What was your background?
I graduated from college back in 2009, but I really wanted to pursue fashion. So after college, I enrolled in SLIMS for fashion school, and then I graduated from dressmaking in 2013. So from 2013, I started making a few pieces under my name for my own brand, and then I also joined a competition. And that competition really helped a lot for my career. So since then, I've been making custom pieces for several clients who really liked my collection back then. And then after that, I also graduated from fashion design and I even took bespoke tailoring. Since then, I've been contributing some of my work in different magazines. I've also worked with different people from the industry and trying to build my brand.
From the very beginning, you've always had your own label, Bea Sampson. Yes. Was it always your intention to create your own label? Was there any intention to work with other designers perhaps first and gain a bit more experience? Why did you choose the path that you did?
In the Philippines, the way I saw it was, if the other designers could do it, I believe I could. And I really wanted my own brand. I really believe that with the training that I got, even my mentor thought that I could be fit, like to work hard and have my own brand. I mean, ideally, you work for someone else first to gain more experience, but I really saw myself as having my own namesake label.
So you always had this vision of having your own label. And of course, when it comes to having your own label, it's not just about the clothes that you produce, but also the branding that goes behind it.
Yes.
What is the main brand concept for Bea Sampson, the label then?
The entire concept is I wanted to make contemporary, luxury, ready-to-wear designs. I'm not really very much focused towards the bridal aspect because in the Philippines, bridal is really what sells here.
It's the same in Malaysia as well. It's amazing how the similarities are there.
I've always loved seeing the different clothes that I see whenever I travel, and not all of them are bridal. So I really wanted to steer away from that direction. And I really wanted to make a brand that I can see and sell in stores. and people can wear, not just for special occasions. So I really wanted to do that.
So there's a lot of similarities there in the sense of the challenges that designers in Manila face as the designers in Kuala Lumpur, in the sense that the make-to-measure market, the bridal market, is almost too tempting to ignore, even if you have a very strong direction towards ready-to-wear in that sense.
Yes.
Is that the reason because you want your clothes to have a bigger audience rather than just a smaller clientele? Is that the reason why you want to do ready-to-wear as well?
Yes. I've always dreamed of seeing different people I admire wear my clothes, like both males and females. That's why I really wanted my own namesake label as well.
Let's talk about the clothes then. What is B. Samson about in terms of the actual clothes then?
Well, I'm really strict when it comes to the quality of the clothes that I make and sell. For me, it's not just really about what you see outside. It's really the make of the garment. It's also about intelligent design. I always mention that because I think it's really what sets you apart.
When you say intelligent design, does that mean that it would translate into the exaggerated silhouettes that your clothes tend to have? Is it about not just clothes that flatter your body, but speaks about the wearer as well?
Yes. In fact, during the first collection that I did back in 2013, I had a top. It looks like a plain ovoid top, but I really wanted it to have a lot of shape. So I really had to figure out how to like insert darts, but strategically place them on the garment. And I really tried my best to, you know, manipulate the patterns as well as the fabric, because I think it's what makes the garments really special.
Now, the collection that you did showcase at the recent KL Fashion Week was certainly special. The silhouettes, for example, quite unconventional with the puff sleeves and, you know, the Victorian exaggerated cinch waist. Tell us a bit more about the inspiration behind that and whether you think that your clients in general will be ready to wear something like that on the streets.
For KL Fashion Week, for the Air Asia competition, I used the National Dress of the Philippines is my main inspiration.
Right.
It's called the terno. And then you also have part of the terno or also the traje de mestiza. They have this component called the panuelo. So it's something that you wrap around like your shoulder area. So I got a lot of inspiration for that. Like my coat was oversized and I had like a really big collar to represent that one. And then, for me, the ternos are really beautiful clothes. I mean, they're really timeless. I'm glad that they're having a comeback now in the Philippines. They're really beautiful clothes. So, for KL Fashion Week, I really wanted to do clothes that are more wearable,
mm-hmm.
or like a more current kind of application of the terno design. So, I really wanted to design clothes that still express the same kind of beauty, the same kind of class and elegance of what the ternos and the traje de mestizos had back then.
You mentioned the terno, the Philippine national costume. As a Filipino designer in a very global fashion world, do you feel that responsibility of, you know, needing to showcase the heritage of a country, the clothes of your country, or do you just feel that, you know, good design is global and can speak for itself in that sense?
I think good design can speak for itself, but at the same time, it makes perfect sense to make more of our heritage known, because I want to promote Filipino talent, and at the same time, I think it would be at least enlightening for other cultures also to know more about the Philippines. So at least I try little by little to insert the Filipino aspect, like either through my fabrics or sometimes through the cut, because I really think they can be made current and they can appeal to what the consumers want nowadays.
Now, being that Filipino representative, not the only one at the recent KL Fashion Week, how did it make you feel? And what did you learn from your experience there as a designer and also seeing, you know, designs from Malaysia shown at the same time?
First of all, it was such an honor to represent the country. I mean, among all of those who auditioned for the Air Asia competition, I was one of the top three. So it was something I looked forward to since the summer. And there was somewhat pressure because I wanted like everything to be perfect, but it was really a good kind because I was able to motivate myself and it was something I really looked forward to, you know, representing the country. And I used also some of the Filipino fabric, so it was a very special project for me. I really learned many things during KL Fashion Week. One of it was that ready-to-wear in other countries, it's very different from what we have here in the Philippines. Because in the Philippines, when you say ready-to-wear, it's more of the commercial ones. Like, you have the different retail giant stores. Like, you have Zara, H&M, Forever 21. They're more of that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's just now that these retail giants are coming in the country. So, the perception of ready-to-wear is very different from abroad. Another thing would be, well, on a lighter note, it would be how to pack fashion show pieces and, you know, transport them to Malaysia. It was a big challenge for me. But it was fun. I mean, I learned how to, like, stuff the suitcases and make sure that none of the garments would be destroyed while in transit. Another thing would be how to fully express and carry myself in front of the different judges, because they come from different backgrounds, different cultures, and not everybody knows about the Filipino cultures, about our heritage, or about, again, the terno. So it's finding a way on how to explain things to them in a very short time, especially during the judging part.
Were there any designers that showed during KL Fashion Week that caught your eye or that you were particularly inspired by?
The street side of me would be DJ Nak. He's from Korea. I've followed him on Instagram for a really long time. I really liked his work. And then I also like Angel Chen.
Mm-hmm.
I really think her designs are really, really cool. And then Motoguo, Katie Yi, and Melinda Louis,
yeah. So there's a nice mix of some new designers and more established designers here in Malaysia. Yeah. Was there any particular look that you were entranced by?
For Katie Yi, it's really hard to pick which one. Everything's so nice and cute and very...
Very Katie Yi in that sense.
Yes. For Motoguo, actually for everyone, it's really hard to pick just the one particular mm-hmm. one because like they're very detailed and they complement each other to make the whole collection. I just really like how, in a way, unique the designs are, but you can clearly see the aesthetic of the designer.
Now, just looking at the ASEAN fashion design scene, if it's actually possible to look at the entirety of this design scene because it's so big. In KL, for example, there is an appreciation of Indonesian designers and Thai designers, but not much is known beyond that realm within this huge space that ASEAN is. Do you feel it's the same in Manila, that, you know, that there's not so much cross-cultural references from one design scene to another within this whole region? Would you like to see more of it, for example, more Filipino fashion being showcased here in Kuala Lumpur and vice versa?
Definitely. I think it's really good if we get more exposed to one another. Like during the competition, I saw the different styles of the different designers who joined the competition as well. And I was really amazed to see how each country presented very creative work, how each country really tried to insert a little bit of their cultural references for their collection. And I think it would be really nice if more Filipinos become known across the ASEAN countries or the region. We have a lot of really good talent here, and I think a lot of us have really great concepts for fashion, and I hope we can have more opportunities to really showcase our work and talent.
Having said all of that, B, now you've made your first foray into Kuala Lumpur just a month ago. Are you looking forward to expand your line, the distribution of your clothes regionally? Is there any plans for going beyond the borders of the Philippines at the moment?
Yes, definitely. It's really part of the plan. I'm building my team here in the Philippines, and then I'm actually launching like a sub-brand of Bea Samson here. I'll be launching that soon. So that will be more of a ready-to-wear brand. And I hope I can be able to find different stockists in the region who can sell my work so I can showcase more in the international scene.
Coming up next, we have Lee Chu Lin and I going over the latest news in the fashion industry. But before that, here's Nuclear Seasons by Charlie XCX, played at Rachel Roy's Spring-Summer 2016 collection in New York. It's Style File on BFM 89.9, bringing fashion to you over the airwaves. I'm Azura Rahman, and it's time for Style Scoop with Lee Chu Lin. Now, the first story for this week is a bit of a downer.
Yes, it is.
Right? It's a stark reminder of how fast fashion always comes at a cost. And we've mainly heard the plight of, you know, garment workers or sweatshop workers in underdeveloped nations as the ones paying the price for fast fashion. There was that famous case of the Rania Garment Center in Bangladesh collapsing, for example. But an investigative piece shows that they're not the only ones in the supply chain that work under ghastly conditions. The piece centered on leading online giant ASOS and its warehouse workers in the UK. Now, this long article by BuzzFeed basically highlighted how workers in their sole warehousing facility in Barnsley in South Yorkshire suffer from onerous working conditions, including being live monitored in the number of orders that they put through, and they can be reprimanded if they fall behind. Staff say they're unable to take regular toilet breaks or water breaks. Workers have had their assignments ended after falling ill at work. Pay is docked if an employee arrives at the warehouse even a single minute late. And agency staff say they are kept on contracts they believe are exploitative, as they allow for them to have assignments and without notice, to be sent home without pay, or to be told not to come in if management decides to cancel their shift at any time. I mean, you wouldn't think that these are the working conditions in the UK, right?
You wouldn't. And thank you, Azura, for taking away another place I can shop at. It's been marvellous. It's been wonderful. No, but it was horrifying. I think because when we have sweatshops in other parts of the world, they don't bother to couch it in niceties. You know, it's just like, look, all of you are here. I'm going to crack the whip. So. But this one, it's kind of horrifying because they couch it in all these first world
terminologies.
Words. Yeah. It's like, oh, you know, I'm sorry, but your productivity is not up to par.
Demand is showing that you'd be flexible with how you work, that kind of thing, right?
And judging by the people that they're interviewing and the things that are their concerns, I think this is a group of deeply disadvantaged people. These are people for whom, you know, an extra day of work is a huge difference, for whom, you know, getting docked 15 minutes pay for being, you know, either on the hour or a minute late is really, you know, something that deeply affects their quality of life. And so that just, it was such a disheartening story.
I think it also highlights the working class conditions in the UK. As you can see in the article, it highlights the fact that Barnsley used to be an ex-mining town. And for a lot of people who continue to live in these towns, their main source of income died when the mines closed. And when something as big as ASOS comes to town with a huge warehousing facility, it means either they or their family or their next door neighbor, someone definitely works for ASOS. That's what a big presence they are. And probably shows the kind of bargaining power they have over the employees who live in this town. It is a very long article, and it spoke to many employees, centered on this lady who is a single mom as well, who suffered from panic attacks on the floor and then was just asked not to come back the next day. It's shocking because at the end of the day, they're trying to feed beast that won't stop. And it just goes to show that fast fashion can never be conscionable.
It also shows how susceptible we are as consumers to ASOS's flash sales, because that's what they said, right? When demand starts to dip and the hours start to go down, what they do is they start pushing out these random sales, and then that can cause huge sales spikes, and that results in workers getting more hours. But workers getting more hours, you know, with I don't know what kind of notice, with the notice of a few hours even, you know, you're just supposed to come in today, come in. Or no, you don't need to come in today, don't. And we're a part of that. You know, every time we see ASOS send an email to us saying 15% off for the next 24 hours, we're part of the problem. We're leading to this woman having a panic attack.
It makes me realize as well, how is it that we are able to afford that amount of fashion at that price tag? Because of the very reactionary way ASOS actually conducts its business. I think if you look at it from a very cold business textbook kind of point of view, you'd admire ASOS for doing what they do. They require workers to be on flexible contracts, but that just means that workers who work under the ASOS banner has to center their life around work and nothing else. In the sense that, you know, you're literally on the beck and call of your employer. And for people who have family or people who have classes, whatever, to run to, they do find they are at the behest of this monster that is ASOS.
It was just something that made me realize. I mean, I said it in jest, but I'm not really joking. I don't think I can buy from ASOS now.
Right.
You know, in much the same way that I can't successfully say I've cut H&M out of my life, but I try, you know. But I don't think I can buy from ASOS.
Because the facts have been presented to you before this, you were just kind of oblivious to it, and you know,
maybe they were happy, you know,
happy elves working at Santa's factory.
I mean, I get that it takes a certain type of company to promise these kinds of fast turnarounds, and like you said, on a purely mathematical efficiency sort of lens, wow, ASOS, have you maxed it out or what? But on a human level, as somebody who doesn't really need that skater dress that's coming in the mail or whatever, I just can't buy from ASOS.
And, you know, it's bad enough that you have to think of garment workers who are probably underpaid.
We haven't even gotten to that.
Right.
I mean, these are the people who are picking and packing. Mm. We haven't even talked yet about the little hands that are putting the clothes
together. Right.
So in terms of, you know, the magnitude of this, yeah, I think I'm tapping out on ASOS.
It's also one of many exposés that I think will literally pick the seams apart at fast fashion. We haven't seen any exposés on Zara, for example, you know. But I think their time will come. Same with your other fast fashion brands. Think of your Cotton Ons, that kind of thing, you know, and what kind of working conditions their workers are under, regardless whether they are based in a first world country or in an underdeveloped country. Somebody's paying for this and we're not paying enough.
I mean, it's going to be a difficult one to cope with, and I'd be curious to hear from people whether or not something like this would be enough to make them give up shopping from places like ASOS.
In the meantime, I think there's a back-to-school sale on ASOS.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, that's time for you to test your conscience.
No, I'm doing nothing. I'm removing them.
Moving on to our next story then. We're talking about old media versus new media in the fashion industry. Now, this argument, Lynn, is starting to take on biblical proportions. And I think it's rather stale, like, you know, skinny jeans are becoming stale. But basically, the latest brouhaha that's come up is four Vogue editors have been captured online complaining about the presence of, in their words, pathetic and desperate fashion bloggers at Milan Fashion Week, reported by The Times. The senior staff members criticised bloggers for changing their outfits every hour, and they said it's distressing, that it's just sad for the women who preen for the cameras in borrowed clothes to watch so many brands also participate. Well, they really had their claws out, didn't they?
No, they
did. And the knives in, twisting as well. And they went on to say as well that it's unfair that this whole practice of paid appearances and borrowed outfits was gross.
I see where they're going with that point. I mean, we've talked about fashion bloggers before, and there is no denying that there is a certain paid-for element when it comes to their fashion weeks in general. If you look at their posts, if you look at the shows that they go to, if you look at the blogs that they get on, there is no denying that there are some borrowed outfits that are there to reach a large audience.
You see that even here during KL Fashion Week, you see celebrities who turn up in designers' outfits head to toe and, you know, toting like 30,000 ringgit bags that are returned right after the catwalk show is over. It's come to here as well, to our shows as well.
So that's how it works. And there is a part of me that does react negatively to that, right? Because it does feel a little bit like, is this really the level of style that we want? Mm. You know, because it's personal style, right? Bloggers especially kind of plump on their personal style. That's the thing that they sell to you. And if their personal style is basically them being brand Barbie dolls, you know, just accepting clothes and modeling them, well, then what's the difference between them and the runway? There's not a whole lot.
Well, to me, at the end of the day, it's down to awareness. I think for people who are more savvy, they would realize that, okay, these guys are obviously being dressed. But at the same time, let's examine Vogue themselves. Okay?
Yes.
They are supposed to be the bastions of fashion reporting, the gold standard, what have you. But if you are an avid reader of the magazine, you would notice that they are also featuring top-to-toe looks on one page of one designer, not mixing designers. We see that also even in our local magazines. We know for a fact beauty credits on covers are actually paid for. It might seem that it's using X Color by Estee Lauder, but they might well be using something else. All of this are being bought and paid for. So what does that say about Vogue and their practices? You know, what does it say about Vogue and the fact that their September issue, 80% of its content is actually advertising? The game is the same. It's just in a new form altogether. And it's whether those who are still players of the old game are feeling jealous of the new players.
Vogue is Vogue.
the irony is they have featured the likes of Chiara Ferragni, who's, you know, obviously a huge Instagram star, you know, with over 3 million followers on one of their covers before. I mean, they want to court the Instagrammers, the bloggers as well, because they know that we'll actually sell magazines.
But they want to be above it as well.
Absolutely. I think you just can't have your cake and eat it too. I think you may just risk sounding out of step. And the fact that they are embracing bloggers on one hand, putting them on their covers, you know, inviting them to the parties and so on, I'm sure they do. But at the same time, you know, they just want to get their knives in and say, you know, well, you know, these guys are not the real deal. We are. We spent X amount of years, you know, studying journalism. We spent X amount of years, you know, basically working on the floor of the Vogue fashion cupboard. Things are changing now. Right? I mean,
that's very fair. Right? I think that's true. Because I don't think it takes away from the work that they've done.
No.
But neither should it take away from the new work of, you know, having to post photos on Instagram.
Right.
I mean, it sounds light, but these women are earning a living out of it and a reputation out of it. And right. I suppose we shouldn't be dismissing it, much as I'm tempted to, and I'm not going to lie.
Okay, for our final story for this week, Sarah Jessica Parker, SJP, launches LBDs, little black dresses. Should we care? I don't know. Sarah Jessica Parker, should you not be familiar with her? If you're around in the noughties watching Sex and the City, of course you would be. She's expanding her design talents from accessories to apparel. 3 years after partnering with Manolo Blahnik to launch a range of footwear and handbags, she's announced on Instagram that she'll be working with Bloomingdale's to launch a new line of little black dresses, and it's called SJP LBD, but of course. And it's entirely designed by her, starting at the price of around $395. My question is, the last Sex and the City movie came out in 2010. Should we still care about Sarah Jessica Parker? I mean, she's not just all about Sex and City, of course, but in many ways she is, right?
She is. I mean, I don't know whether a lot of us can think of her style as completely distinct from that of Carrie Bradshaw. You know, there is that element of it. I mean, she's always been a stylish woman, but did we think that before Sex and the City?
I think not. I thought more of Carrie Bradshaw than Sarah Jessica Parker, to be honest. When I do see Sarah Jessica Parker dressing up the red carpet, I do feel that she's putting her Carrie Bradshaw on.
Right?
Right?
But, you know, who's
to
say?
You see her in her sweats and her Uggs, you think, no, that ain't Carrie Bradshaw.
That's not Carrie Bradshaw. But, I mean, who's to say? Maybe Carrie Bradshaw was informed by SJP's style. That, you know, we can't say for sure that...
Okay.
Yeah.
You're being generous there.
I recognize that. But am I excited about SJP's LBDs? Yes and no. I
mean, is she still a relevant name to you in fashion?
Maybe just in terms of a small perv on the red carpet.
Right.
You know, when she pops up, I'm still interested to know what she's going to wear.
Right.
We've talked about celebrity collaborations in the past, notably Alexa Chung, and there our reactions were entirely different. But Sarah Jessica Parker, I want to see what it'll look like, but I don't want to buy it.
My thoughts have always been, why is it that she did not, you know, flog this horse when she was actually acting? Maybe, I guess, at the time, during, you know, the early noughties, late 90s, celebrity collaborations were still very much thin on the ground. And this is something that's only become really popular in the past 5-10 years or so. But, you know, she has come up with fragrances before, you know, and that did well for her. But I don't know whether people will be queuing up for this one. I very much doubt so, especially at that price point as well.
Yes, and I'm not even sort of eagerly anticipating the online release of photos. I'll see it when it comes out. I'm not denying that I'm going to click through the slideshow just like everybody else, but I'm certainly not raring to go and get me one of those $500 dresses.
Well, for the Eternal Carrie fans, the first dress that she has modeled on her Instagram account looks very Carrie-like. It will be launching in a couple of months' time soon on bloomingdales.com. Not something I'll be queuing up for either.
I don't think so.
After the break, Emma Chong Johnson, managing editor of Elle Malaysia, gets a feel for the trend for velvet. It's Azura Rahman on Style File. Next up, we have Emma Chong Johnson of Elle Malaysia getting down with another fabric for the new season, velvet. And we are looking at the other fabric of the season. And I say fabric of the season, though, but I've seen velvet infiltrate some collections for summer this year.
Yeah.
Velvet is huge now at the moment, right?
Yeah, it really is. And I don't think anyone would have thought it, like going back a few years, that velvet would be trendy again.
So big.
But yeah, velvet. So this time we're looking at it in a lot of, in lighter shades. So not your traditional kind of dark purples and your oxbloods and your bordeaux and things like that. This time it's paler. So yellows, pale pinks, seafoam, just really kind of nice, light, fresh colours.
Something like what Victoria Beckham wore recently, which is part from her next year's spring-summer collection, which was a light, wasn't really a mint green, but almost like a fluorescent mint green.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Is there a certain kind of shape that velvet would suit best to make it look very current?
It's coming in a lot of different forms this season. I think on the runway there were lots of head-to-toe looks, so like there was this Valentino mustard floor-length gown. But this time around, it comes in lots of different ways. So I've seen velvet t-shirts, velvet skater skirts, you know, velvet shoes, obviously velvet bags, really easy to do. But yeah, it is a heavy fabric, and I think the whole bodycon velvet thing is definitely not happening anymore.
That's too 80s, man.
Yeah, so think relaxed, think like lots of flowing lines and lots of movement.
As opposed to something that's heavy and
constricting, and, or yeah.
Right, so the colours, obviously you say it's very important. What about the weight of it? Because, you know, there's heavier velvet, there's lighter ones. Are we looking at something that's a bit more, less hot in this climate as well?
Yeah, but a good way around this is crushed velvet, which is also really big this season. And it's also a bit more forgiving because thinner velvets can kind of show every bump and every line, whereas crushed velvet can kind of, you know, there's a bit more leeway to it.
Now, crushed velvet gives me memories of the 80s in a very bad way. How do you prevent from looking like a throwback from the 80s in that sense then?
Well, I'm hoping that the colours alone will help that because they are different colours to what we've seen before. Yeah, not so rich and dark and borderline goth. But also just pairing it in unexpected ways. You know, I always say this, denim is a good way of kind of
Anchoring things down.
Yeah, and making things a bit more modern. And also with a white shirt layered underneath or layered over. And things like shorter lengths or different proportions, playing around with that can help.
Right. Would you do a velvet dress or would that be a bit too much for the look that you're trying to achieve with velvet this season?
I mean, I think a velvet dress is beautiful, but you have to make sure that you get the right one. So yeah, I think it would be something quite unstructured and quite flowy, not the kind of nipped in waist and skater skirt style, just like something a bit more modern, like a shift dress, but in velvet would be amazing.
Would it be worth your while to look at the back of your wardrobe and look at, you know, some of the old velvet pieces?
Yeah, definitely look at your mum's wardrobe, yeah. Go for it.
But steer away from the dated references. So the colours is very important.
And also, like, no black velvet. Don't do black velvet.
Don't do black velvet. Okay, right. And that was this week's episode of Style File. If you've missed any parts of the show, catch up with our podcast on www.bfm.my/stylefile. And don't forget to show us some love on our Facebook page, Style File on BFM 89.9. Before we go, though, we leave you with Ellipsis by Joy Orbiso, played at Lacoste Spring-Summer 2016 collection in New York. This has been Style File with Azura Rahman on BFM 89.9.